And now, live from Sharp Facets Gallery, it's time for the I Love Ann Show.
Right. It is time for the I Love Ann Show, the continuation of the I Love Ann Show, and I am Ann Eller. And, of course, today is Pearl Harbor Day, and that was a day that for many, many, many years has been very significant. Now, kind of, because I guess we have other big events that have happened to us, but still we should never forget about Pearl Harbor. In fact, at 8:54 in the morning on that December 7th, the second Japanese attack, 168 aircraft targets right there on Hickman Field and Pearl Harbor aircraft, 78 dive bombers, 54 high-level bombers, and 36 fighters. So this fight was well underway just a little bit before we started talking here this morning. So something to think about. Altogether, there were 2,403 American military personnel killed in the attack. Of those, 1,077 died on the USS Arizona, which is at rest there in Pearl Harbor. My guest today, Jim Morgan, he was a young boy. What were you, 9 or 10?
9 years old.
9 years old at that time. I'll bet it is as clear today, though, as it was when it was happening, Jim.
It's something you can't forget about. It was very scary.
Scary.
Unknown. Didn't know what was going on. Certainly didn't expect an aerial attack.
What were you doing that morning?
My mother woke me up about 7:30 and came upstairs. I lived in Navy housing on the base, and it was a two-story unit, a fourplex. There were four units together. And we had an upstairs and downstairs. My bedroom was on the front, the west side of the building facing the harbor. And I looked out the window, and she came up to wake me again, make sure I was up. And looking out the window to the west, and there's a big tower out there. It was on the submarine base. And it looked like there was a fire in the submarine base. It was flames and smoke and what have you. I had no idea what was going on. I said to my mother that there's a fire in the sub base, and she looked out, and about that time a plane came right over our house, probably not 50 feet in the air, and she saw a big red insignia on the side of the plane. She said, "I don't know whose they are. They're not ours. You know, let's get out of here." And so we ran next door, the lady next door. My dad was at sea that morning, and we went next door. The lady there, her husband was on my dad's ship too, and she had two younger children than myself, and we, my mother got us all, put us in the car. I don't know where we were going to go, but she apparently flooded the engine. It was an old Chevrolet and couldn't get it started.
That was nerves.
Yeah, we ended up going back into the house and looking around in a house in Hawaii with no basement. A clothes closet under the stairwell looked like about the safest place to be, so that's where the kids and I hid.
Now, just out of curiosity, had there been any, that if something happened, what you should do? Had there been any pre-preparations or drills or anything, even living on the base?
Yes. As a matter of fact, they started giving us some indication that something was going on. They issued gas masks to all of us. I've got a picture
of that. I'll bet as a kid you thought that was great.
Oh, yeah. this was fun, just another toy. But my mother and I each were fitted with gas masks, and this was within a month of the attack actually taking place. Afterwards, I found out that they couldn't believe that aircraft could do this, that the Japanese could
fly in that low and
bring six carriers in close enough to bomb Pearl Harbor. It's just, you know, unheard of.
And a surprise that nobody would know about it.
Yeah. We thought, or the Navy thought, that their biggest fear was either local saboteurs, the number of Japanese that lived in Hawaii at that time, which prompted them to move all their aircraft wingtip to wingtip and make a perfect target for an airplane.
That was so smart, wasn't
it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right.
And, but they thought the attack would be either sabotage, but no large-scale thing. Once the attack started, then they expected an invasion. Everybody got pretty prepared that the troops were right behind the the aircraft. And, of course, that never happened, but it was a frightful event, I guess is the best way to describe it.
You know, had your dad prepared you that if he was gone and something happened, that you were the man of the house?
No. I was the only child, but
I know,
no. I guess
that you had to take care of your mom. I meant,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I was the oldest in our family, and my father was always preparing me. If I'm not, because he traveled, he was a traveling
uh-huh.
salesman. Now you have to be in charge if you know something happens, and I'm a kid. What do you want me to do? But that was more the way, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I guess it was.
Yeah.
And he would go out. He was in a group of four destroyer. His ship was the USS Ward. And it was one of four destroyers that rotated every fourth week, and they spent a week at sea, at patrolling the entrance to the harbor. They just go back and forth, and their big fear was submarines. They thought that a major part of the attack would come from submarines, and there were 30 submarines in Japanese water, in Hawaiian waters, the morning of the attack. And
the Ward get hit. Did the Ward get hit, and they didn't realize they had gotten hit, and there was a torpedo went through it?
No. The Ward was ironically it fired the first U.S. shot of World War II. They sunk a submarine at 6:45 in the morning of the attack,
and
it was sunk all ironically on December 7th, 1944, in the Philippine Islands. And it had been hit by a kamikaze, and one of the engines of it was a twin-engine plane that hit them. One of the engines went completely through the Ward. That may be what you were thinking of, and out the other side.
Because I think I know somebody that was on the Ward.
Oh, really?
Think. That's why, because the Ward, I went on an honor flight,
okay.
And I have pictures and everything where the Ward, I think it's the Ward, and this gentleman lives here in South Carolina still. I was on an honor flight with him back in the spring, I think.
Okay.
That name just rings a bell. I'm going to have to look that up.
Right. Well, the Ward actually was manned by a group of naval reservists from Minnesota.
Oh, okay.
Probably 85 of the 120 men that were on that ship were reservists from Minnesota. And that's how my dad happened to get up over there. He was a reservist, called to active duty in 1940. And the Navy trained their reservist to go as a crew. And they were sent out to San Diego and picked up this destroyer Ward that was an old World War I destroyer and reconditioned it and took it over to Honolulu, or over to Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where or how we got there.
Wow.
And we happened to be there.
Now, once all this started happening, you said, y'all went back and you got in the coat closet?
Right, we got in the closet. The attack actually probably was a better part of an hour, 45 minutes maybe, the first attack.
Right.
And we all went outside when things calmed down, and it was just, the smoke was so thick, you couldn't see probably 50 yards. The whole of Battleship Row, which was basically six battleships and a couple of work vessels,
mm-hmm.
Out on Ford Island, which was a little over a mile from my house. And just all of them were hit, all of them were burning. To this day, the Arizona is still leaking oil. I was just out there in November, and you can still see bubbles of oil coming up from that battleship that's been in the bottom of the ocean for 71 years.
Now, you went out there because your dad's ashes, correct?
Right. My dad passed away in 2004 at the age of 93, and the Navy had a program where any survivor from the Navy could have his ashes spread at Pearl Harbor, and he wanted to take advantage of that, so we arranged that. As I say, he passed away in 2004, and we knew they were going to have a ceremony for him. We never could quite get together as to the timing, so we weren't there for the ceremony. But they did send us a DVD of the program, and it was beautifully done. They had a 21-gun salute. They have a Navy chaplain was there. They had the presenting of the flag and the whole
ceremony.
Military service, and it was great. And this year was the first opportunity that we really had to get back and see where this all happened. And that's what I wanted to do, and that's what we did. And
absolutely.
It was really interesting.
When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about his latest trip over there and what he saw. So I certainly hope you'll stay with us. I am talking to Jim Morgan, a child survivor of World War II, right there at Pearl Harbor. Don't you go away. We'll be right back. Hey, if you got a question for Jim, don't hesitate to give us a call. 229-7984. That's 229-7984. We'll be right back.
Gold, more precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
And now, live from Sharp Facets Gallery, it's time for the I Love Ann Show.
All right, we're right back here at Sharp Facets Gallery. We're trying to figure out if maybe Jim Morgan's dad and the gentleman that I interviewed that I've got to look up that was on the honor flight with us when we went up there in May, who was, I believe it was the Ward, but I got to check this out. That would just be too amazing, wouldn't it?
It would be.
It would,
right.
Absolutely. But we are talking about there are 45 remaining Pearl Harbor survivors still in South Carolina, right?
We or is that, couldn't guarantee that. That would be the maximum.
Is that in South Carolina?
In South Carolina.
In South Carolina.
In the last roster I've got was from 2006, and we had 67 survivors at that living at that time. And 22 of these have since passed away, and leaving 45 maximum.
Sure.
Unfortunately, we can't get a hold of 90% of these
sure.
addresses don't exist or aren't.
Or they've changed.
Nobody's there,
right,
or
yeah.
the phone
or
numbers aren't correct. So we don't have a very good accounting.
Still, that's not very many.
No.
That's not very many. And, you know, I think, I don't know if you've ever been on an honor flight, but it is an absolutely awe-inspiring experience to be on a plane with 80 or so guys and even gals that were in the war, signed up. I talked to a lady who was a decoder, okay?
Okay.
And she was in the state of Washington off the coast there. And even her husband didn't know what she was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And she signed up for the war just because she was sitting there watching a movie with her girlfriend, I think it was in Texas, and at the end of the movie they say, the U.S. Army needs you. And they went and signed up.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
sure enough, she ended up decoding messages.
Right.
When her husband, just a quick story, when her husband, she met her future husband, they were in school together, they went in different directions. She went out to, as I said, off the coast of the state of Washington, and he was in another. He ended up getting out because he ended up with pneumonia. He got sick. Well, he trekked out there and wanted to marry her. When they wanted to get married, they had a real problem, folks, because every girl, she wanted all the girls that were out there with her to be in her wedding. Well, they had to have somebody to keep decoding the messages. But you know what? They worked it out. That's another fascinating story from Pearl Harbor, from World War II. World War II. But we're talking about Pearl Harbor, the start of it all. Your dad was there. You were there. And when you went back, I thought this was very interesting. When you went back to survey the Arizona and see where they had spread your dad's ashes, you saw some very interesting things.
Yes. I want to make one thing clear. The Navy had this program for spreading of the ashes. If you had been a survivor of the Arizona, they would actually put the ashes on board the ship. They send divers down and put the ashes, and there's something like 20 or 25 people that have had that done. If you weren't a Pearl Harbor, weren't on the Arizona, they would spread your ashes over the area where your ship was at the time. My dad's ship was on patrol at the entrance of the harbor. They recommended not doing that. They wanted to videotape the service. and you'd be in a small boat and it'd be bouncing around. So they recommended doing it at the Utah Memorial. And so that was a target ship. It had been a battleship, been converted into a target ship. It took two torpedoes and sunk at its mooring on the west side of Ford Island. And there's still a little bit of the remains of the ship. It's virtually rusted away, mm-hmm. but they do have a monument there and a platform, and that's where my dad's ashes were spread.
Okay, okay. So what did you see when you went back? So when did you actually go back? This year?
Yes, it was in November of this year, and we went out to I kept track of the, kept in touch with the fellow that worked for the Navy. He was a retired sailor. He worked for the Navy, and he was the funeral director that took care of spreading of the ashes, Jim Taylor by name. And anyway, I got a hold of Jim, who's since retired from that job, and my wife and I, my sister-in-law and niece were there, and he took us on a private tour of Ford Island and got to see some rather interesting sights, in addition to just what had happened at Pearl Harbor. But if you've got an opportunity to go to Hawaii, go to Honolulu, and see the Arizona Memorial. It's fantastic. Not just where the ship was, but the museum that they have in conjunction with it. It's a beautiful layout, very detailed.
It bring back a lot of memories.
Yes, it did. It had a lot of pictures of what was going on that day. Most of these, or a lot of these pictures that I've seen, I've been a collector of these things all my life, and I've got a number of magazines showing Japanese aerial photographs, and you can see where my house was. I was, as I mentioned, the plane came right over our house. We were directly east of where the battleship row was, and the ocean was probably not two blocks from my house, so they were coming in. The harbor was very shallow for these torpedo bombers to drop their torpedoes and not have them sink into the mud in the bottom of the harbor. They had to be coming in low and flat, and consequently right over our house, you know, was right on line with the battleships. And so we had a first row seat there. And after the...
What you want, first row seat for this now,
yeah.
folks. Yes,
right.
The bombing of Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
Okay.
The... there was a lull, as I started to say, between the two raids, and we all went outside, and that's when I said it would you couldn't see anything for the smoke and fire. Some of those ships burned for 2 weeks afterwards. These oil fires, they couldn't put them out, and we were all standing out in the front yard, not knowing what's going on, and the Marines came roaring up and down the streets with a pickup truck with a machine gun in the back of it, telling us, get back in the house or we'll shoot you. And that was...
That's pretty stern to a 9-year-old, isn't it? Did it scare you?
Yes, it did. We went back in the house, but then that second attack took place, and it was more of the same. They didn't have the torpedo bombers in the second attack. They came in the first attack. And the big disappointment to the Japanese were... There were normally three aircraft carriers based at Pearl Harbor. All of them were at sea that morning, so they weren't hit. The eight battleships that were there were all hit. Two of them were completely destroyed, the Arizona and the, I can't think of the other one, but the Oklahoma, I believe it was, never were put back into service. And the other six were put back into action. But the biggest fear was just not knowing what was going on.
Absolutely, and of course you weren't able to contact your dad.
Oh,
but,
no,
I
right,
mean,
well,
you know.
That was another story. Dad's ship came in to resupply on the afternoon, about 1 o'clock in the afternoon after the attack stopped. They came back in to get more ammunition, and... they couldn't contact us, and we couldn't contact them. You know, no such thing as a cell phone back in those days, and really no way of communicating. I don't know if telephones even worked. But
You would imagine probably, even if there was on the base, they probably would have just shut everything down, right?
Yeah. We didn't know for 3 or 4 days whether he was okay, or he didn't know if we were okay. But,
exactly.
It was pretty traumatic, I guess.
Absolutely. Well, we are here with Jim Morgan. I was going to have Peggy come on by, but I think we're going to just give her a call. We're going to continue this with Jim Morgan here this morning, try to get some more details about Pearl Harbor and feel what it was like to be back there then, and see what else we can get into here this morning. So news is up. We'll be back. Don't you go away. If you've got a question for Jim or you'd like some more information, hey, don't hesitate to give us a call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984.
This is Philip Biffle, your Greenwood Edward Jones Financial Advisor. Do you have a recovery plan for your investments? If not, there are several reasons we think you should. While interest rates are very low, certain income strategies and investments could help increase your investment income. Also, many investment portfolios are out of balance at a time when proper investment diversification may be most critical. You also may want to review your portfolio to consider replacing lower quality investments with higher quality investments that may be at attractive prices. No one can control what the market will do next. You can, however, take advantage of investment opportunities that exist today. At the same time, it is important to be well positioned for whatever the market does tomorrow. Please call me, Philip Biffle, or stop by my office today to develop your personalized recovery plan investment strategy. Please call me, Philip Biffle, at 229-0444, or stop by my office today to develop your personalized recovery plan investment strategy. Edward Jones, Making Sense of Investing, member SIPC.
And now, live from Sharp Facets Gallery, it's time for the I Love Ann Show.
That's right. It's a continuation of the I Love Ann Show. I just said to Peggy, hey, we're going to keep talking because, you know, it's not very, very often you get the opportunity to talk to somebody who was there at Pearl Harbor. So, no, he wasn't in the Navy. His dad was, and he was 9 years old at that time. So, very interesting to have you here today, Jim Morgan, and glad you could come by and spend some time with us. Now, we want to talk about some of the other aspects, but we should tell people that there is an organization of the Sons and Daughters, the
right.
Survivors of Pearl Harbor. Well, this was the Sons and Daughters.
Sons and Daughters of the Pearl Harbor Survivors.
And then there was an organization for Pearl Harbor Survivors, but you were just telling me they've actually disbanded that.
Right. The National Pearl Harbor Survivors Association was disbanded as of December 31st of 2011. You can imagine the youngest person today would be 88. If he was 17 at the time of the attack, which was the youngest age you could be in the military,
sure.
He'd be 88 today. So, and, you know, most of the people were older than that. So you're talking to a group of men and women that are now 90 plus. My dad, as I say, died in 04, and he was 93 at the time, but he was 31. He was older than the average person. I'm sure the average age of the people that were there were like 19 and 20 years old.
Absolutely.
And so they've...
What have they done with that organization?
I was going to say they finally agreed that they could no longer travel to Hawaii for reunions and meetings, et cetera. And the association turned all their assets over to an organization called the Pacific Historic Parks. And it's a group of four types of parks.
Mm-hmm.
They maintain a park in the Arizona monument at Pearl Harbor. They've got an organization run a park in Guam, another one in Saipan, and they are part of the National Park of the U.S. Park Service, and so they have taken over the assets and the all the memorabilia and assets that they
will maintain
had.
That for perpetuity,
and they will maintain that, right?
Right. So you know, we actually have Reed just got here, and we actually are videotaping this now. So for the last half, it'll actually be videotaped, and we will be putting that on YouTube. Now the first part we didn't, but we'll have the audio with that, and then the video for the last part. So this is something that for years and years and years, and for those that really don't have any understanding, I mean, we have a lot of young people here that Pearl Harbor is just a distant distant memory. It's becoming just a blip in the history books, isn't it?
That's exactly right, and that's one of the duties that we have as sons and daughters of the Pearl Harbor survivors, is to keep the memory alive of what happened on December 7th, 1941.
Yes, that's right. So today, what do you look back in as you're sitting here this morning? What are you thinking about?
Well, I was, blessed with the opportunity, if you want to put it that way, of seeing history being made, be it good, bad, or indifferent, sometimes experience those things. And the deaths of those sailors and airmen and Marines were just unbelievable at the time. I have a friend in the Sons and Daughters who was living on Ford Island. I mean, that is, they had a battleship in their backyard, and they were literally pulling the dead and wounded out of the ocean and up onto the beach in their backyard. And that was, I never experienced anything like that. I didn't see anybody getting killed or blown up or anything close proximity.
That's right. But you know, that is the thing. We have fought where it was needed to protect our liberty, to protect our freedoms. And today we are still fighting wars. But, it's a continuous process. I mean, it would be wonderful if we could have learned from that experience and had no more wars or had no 9/11 and this type of thing. But the reality is that these type of things are still happening. There are still people out there who want to hurt and destroy America and other countries, not just America, but other countries too.
Absolutely. That's you look at what could happen with Syria right now. They're talking that if they should use nerve gas, we're going to retaliate some way or other. I don't know exactly what they've got in mind, but they certainly have something in mind. And, well, they should.
The thing that's upsetting about this, though, Jim, is that over and over and over in history, we go to war. It's going to be, the war to end all wars, right?
Yep.
This is not going to happen again. And then the same thing happens. It would seem, after all these years, that we could finally learn a lesson, wouldn't it? We have the United Nations that was formed to help protect and keep these things from happening and try to keep cooler heads prevailing. And yet today, we still have war.
Yeah, that's. I don't know if it can ever be stopped, because there's always going to be some fool that's going to, push the envelope. Some maniac, I guess, is the only way to describe them.
Sure.
We've had them throughout history. World War One was called the Great War, the war to end all wars.
Yeah.
It lasted about 20 years with peace after that.
From
1918 until 1937, World War II actually started in Europe.
That wasn't the war to end all wars. That really didn't stick in anybody's brain real well, did it?
Not real well. That was the League of Nations, I think, that was formed after that war, and then the UN after the World War II. And I wish it could end, but I don't see a way that it ever could.
Absolutely,
because there's going to be somebody wanting to do harm to somebody because of their belief, or I don't like the way you look, or the way you dress, or whatever. And it's just, it's ridiculous, but it happens.
I think the thing about World War II, particularly Pearl Harbor, we were asleep at that moment. We were asleep. And I think, today, as we look at the military and they talk about sequestration and pulling back the military and this type of thing from a force, we need a strong force, and we need a force that is alive and
Absolutely.
Not asleep.
They've got people today that are so well-trained and can do things so much differently than was done back in those days. It's just incredible. One aircraft can do as much damage today as a whole Air Force could do in World War II. They've got, one weapon exceeds all the bombs that were dropped in World War II type of thing. And that's scary.
Absolutely.
Living here in South Carolina, you get a little concerned. I wouldn't necessarily want to live in New York or Los Angeles or one of those major targets, but what would stop some fool from setting off a dirty bomb around here?
Well, you know, we have the Savannah River plant. We have other places. So, so there are reasons, and of course, a lot of our intel comes in right out of the mountains here, not too far away. So, it's then with the distance and everything. But, you know, I just think sometimes we ought to sit down and think about the past and where we're going in the present and the future, because that's one of the biggest things we can learn is the history. And unfortunately, when I was in school, I didn't think history was important. And now that I'm older, I think history is real important. So we are here with Jim Morgan here this morning. We're going to hear a quick word from our sponsors. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about Pearl Harbor. We kind of got off base here on a little politics, but for those of you that know me, you understand. When we come back, though, we're going to talk some more about Pearl Harbor, the survivors, what's going on over there in Pearl Harbor. We'll be back in just a moment. Hey, like I said, if you've got a question, don't hesitate to give us a call. 229-7984. That's 229-7984.
Gold dust at my feet.
This year will be a simpler year, one fine gift to last a lifetime from Mother Earth with love, a diamond to light the way and create the energy to keep your love alive. Only at Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72 Greenwood, 229-6276.
And now, live from Sharp Facets Gallery, it's time for the I Love Ann Show.
Oh, that's right. We are right here at Sharp Facets Gallery on the 72 Bypass. I am here with Jim Morgan, and we just had a question come in, Jim. Somebody, Joe Morgan, wants to know what happened with your dad after Pearl Harbor. We'll get to that in just a second, and we'll actually answer that question. We were just discussing the fact that it was, what, 3 or 4 days before you even knew if your dad was...
Right. We had no idea whether they were safe or not. They had come in and refueled on Sunday afternoon, refueled and resupplied, and they couldn't get a hold of us, and we couldn't get a hold of... We didn't know they were in.
Or, this was before cell phones and face-to-face Skyping and all the chatting and everything that goes on now.
Yeah, yeah, none of that whatsoever.
How was your mom? I was just thinking about this. How was your mom? Did you have any perception that she was scared or frightened?
Yeah, she was fairly excited. She was not an excitable woman by any stretch of the imagination, but she, when the car wouldn't start, she was a little bit upset about that, and we all, you know, I don't know where we would have gone.
Right.
I think there were probably more. There were no civilian deaths that I know of dependents.
Right.
Nothing was hit in Navy housing, and so we were probably safer where we were than.
But you don't think that at that moment.
The Japanese pilots had, you know, they were told specifically, go after the biggest ships you can find.
Mm-hmm.
Go after the biggest targets you can find. And that's why they went, there were these six battleships right in a row, all tied up, and they were just sitting ducks, just absolute sitting ducks. And, you know, it took a fair bit of time to get the ammunition out to get to the guns, even to a machine gun. And all hell's breaking loose all around you, and you know, you're trained to do it, but it's still going to take you some time. And you mentioned
when they say man all battle stations,
yeah,
here, it takes a little bit to get that rolling. Yeah,
especially the larger caliber guns, the machine guns, I guess, came out pretty quick. But the larger weapons. It was noted in the difference of the Japanese losses between the first raid and the second raid. They only lost like 29 airplanes out of the 180 in one raid and 150 in another raid. They lost, you know, virtually nobody.
Yeah.
It was the second raid, though, was about three times more people shot, their plane shot down, than in the first raid, because by now they had it was an hour later, and they had time to get the weapons going.
Sure, yeah. Exactly.
But no, my dad's ship went out, and like I say, they'd sunk a submarine an hour before the attack. And they radioed in and said they had sunk a sub, and they radioed back and said, verify it. Well, in 2002, that submarine was found in 1,200 feet of water by a submersible from the University of Hawaii, and it had a 4-inch shell hole in the conning tower. It's sitting perfectly upright on the bottom of the ocean. I've got pictures of it, and with a 4-inch shell hole right where the conning tower joins the body of the submarine. This was one of those small two-man subs,
sure.
85 feet long. And
But for years, didn't they say that didn't exist and that didn't happen?
Oh, yeah.
And it was just became declassified in the last, like you're saying, but for many years they said that never happened. And I know, who else do I know that somebody told me, we saw this happened, and they said, no, you didn't.
The ship was only 50 yards away from the submarine when they hit it. They fired two shots at it. The first one from the bow gun, that missed a little bit high. And by that time, it was about 100 yards away. And by that time, they were going at them at about as fast as that destroyer could go, which is 25, 30 miles an hour. And they don't think the sub ever saw them because they were coming up behind and beside it. And but the second gun that the shell hit, and everybody said, hey, you know, there it is. We saw it. We saw the shell go into the sub.
I know the gentleman. He was in the Navy. He was actually on the beach. I can't think of his name right now, but he was on the beach when that happened with another friend. They had been going swimming just like they did every afternoon, and the Marines or whatever came back and told him to get back to base, but they saw that happen.
Okay, and was that Russ Miney?
It's a gentleman who lives in Charleston,
okay.
South Carolina. I saw him at the
I've heard that story.
Yes.
I've heard that story, and yes. I think I've met this person, and
yes.
I just can't remember who it was.
And he and his wife were at an honor flight event, and I was there,
okay.
And I got to interview him and talk to him, and I've got pictures and everything from talking to him, and he
uh-huh.
tells me that story
right.
of seeing that and them telling them for years that, no, you didn't, no, you didn't.
Well, the submarine was trailing a Navy transport into the harbor.
Right.
At the entrance of the harbor, they have torpedo nets, anti-torpedo nets, and they'd open the torpedo nets up to let this transport in, and the submarine was trying to sneak in behind it. The crew, some of the crew on the transport saw the submarine, radioed the ward, which was on patrol, and a PBY, a flying boat, was above, was flying over at the same time. So people, you know, all kinds of people saw it. Of course, the same thing happened on the other end of the island, where that Army radar station picked up a huge flight of targets.
Right.
And they were told, ignore it, we've got 17 B-17s coming in from the U.S., which actually they arrived in the middle of the attack. These American B-17s did. And
after the first of the year, we need to get down and compare notes, because I've got a lot of good stuff, and we're going to have to get together and see
it.
Yeah. I know I've got pieces of the puzzle here, and you have another piece of the puzzle, and we're going to have to try to put it all together.
Absolutely.
That would be terrific. So now, let's go back to the day there at Pearl Harbor, though. You said you're, what did you do right, so you went back inside and you hid, and then they came and told you to get back in the house. So
yep.
Did you stay in the house the whole time during
Pearl
Harbor? Well,
the next raid came immediately after that, and it was probably, I would guess, 1 o'clock in the afternoon or whatever before we were able to get out and about. The Marines were, we had a big vacant lot next to our house, and the Marines were over there digging a machine gun nest, anti-aircraft machine gun. This was maybe,
What a great thing for a 9-year-old.
This was maybe 50 yards down the road from our house, and they were putting in this machine gun, and it was a big tripod base on it, and 50 caliber machine gun, pretty big caliber gun. And these three Marines manned that thing, and they lived there. They stayed there. They ended up putting up a tent and all that stuff and just stayed there for, you know, as long as I could remember.
And you stayed right there in your house?
Yeah.
Did you go out there and visit with them? Hey, guys, what's happening?
No, not at that time. But later on, it became a pretty good playground for us. They had all the these three young Marines out there. I still remember their name, Goosey, Greasy, and Chick.
Goosey,
I swear
Greasy,
to God, that
Chick.
that was the name of those Marines. And, you know, it was a good hangout place for kids. We didn't go back to school until probably by January, the first part of January we went back. School classes started again.
Now, see, I'm fascinated with your mom. I'm thinking about your mom here. When y'all went back inside, did she fix you? Did she go ahead and fix food?
I don't remember.
You
that.
Don't remember?
Yeah.
See, those are the. If it was Jeff, he'd be able to tell us. Yes, and we had peanut butter and jelly, and it was strawberry. But you know how
I'm sure she fed us, but.
But you know how everybody, you know, when in stressful situations, right? It's always we got to fix some food or something.
Yeah.
So I was just thinking about
that.
Yeah.
That's true. I'm sure she fed us, but.
You don't remember going hungry.
No.
All right.
I do have a funny food story, and I don't know why, but within a day, 2 days, we used to have milk delivered to us, you know, back in the old milk bottle days.
Sure.
And all of a sudden, the milk was, instead of being nice white, fresh milk, it was powdered milk, and it was a gray-looking, slimy water, and you had to shake up the bottle to get, you know, get
right,
everything
exactly.
remixed. But within 2-3 days of the attack, the fresh milk went away, and powdered milk showed up. The same with eggs. We didn't get any more fresh eggs, and it was just powdered eggs immediately.
Wow.
You know, within a couple of days of the attack, and just I still don't like eggs, and I still don't drink milk.
It's all because of that experience with the powdered
so.
Stuff.
I
yeah,
think so.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, we are coming up on 10 o'clock here, Jim. So we're going to have to wrap this up. What else would you like to tell us here that is important for us to know today? And like I said, after the first of the year, when I've got some time, I'd love to sit down and see if we can't piece some of the puzzle together with the pieces I've gotten from people I've interviewed and what you know.
Well, we ended up being evacuated on February 13th, and it took us until March 3rd to get. But we were in convoy. It took us until March 3rd to get to San Francisco. That happened to be my 10th birthday.
What a birthday present.
Pretty good birthday present, yeah.
Exactly.
And then my mother and I took the train back to St. Paul, and that's where I was raised. My dad stayed in the Pacific the entire war, obviously survived, and had a number of harrowing tales to tell. In fact, on our way back, the Japanese claimed that they had sunk our ship, and it wasn't until, we got ashore
that
they
were
able to prove, and my dad found out that we weren't hit. We had some alerts on the way back in the convoy. Some of our escort ships were chasing something, and we never did, and dropping depth charges, but we never knew what happened. But it was probably the Japanese submarine claiming that claimed they sunk us that didn't, thank
wow.
goodness. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a fascinating day, and the reason we are celebrating having Jim here today is remembering Pearl Harbor, of course, December 7th, 1941. So, Jim, I really appreciate you coming out here today.
Right. Thank you.
And,
I appreciate the opportunity to keep December 7th and Pearl Harbor in the minds of the public.
Absolutely. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. We do have a partial video. We'll post the whole thing, of course, as a podcast and the video on YouTube. So stay tuned. That one will be coming up. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Hey, coming up at 4 o'clock, you know what it is. Giveaway Friday. That's right, where I ask the really stupid, really easy, I can't believe you asked that question, Anne. And Pearl Harbor Day may be one of the questions today. So if you were listening this morning, you'll be one up. Hey, don't you go away. Coming up, we'll join the news in progress, and then we'll carry on from there. But I'll be back at 4 o'clock. And don't forget, tomorrow morning, from Trash to Treasures, along a country road, we will be featuring Loretta Lynn and a whole lot of good holiday classic country music. Hope you tune in. And we'll be right here at Sharp Passes Gallery with our open house. That's going to do it for me. Thanks again, Jim, for coming out today.
Thank you, Anne.
All right. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. Bye-bye, everybody.